All right, y'all, it's spring, and you know what that means. It's time to start planning our summer festival traveling. Yep, it's time to get into my Airbnb bag cross-country, a.k.a. Time to visit my homes all across the country. And you know what I never think about? Why not list my own spot on Airbnb and host some folks at my house? I mean, my house is cute. Yes, let's make money while we're spending money. Just trying to help you out, man, because your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work and traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio.
Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
I may have moved.
Yeah.
You could say I roamed.
Yeah.
But I'm back in the studio.
Yeah.
Ain't no place like home.
Roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call.
My name is Fonte.
Yeah.
My favorite movie is Belly.
Yeah.
I just learned that the plural of cello is celli.
Roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call.
My name is Sugar.
Yeah.
I keep it mellow.
Yeah.
When Larry Gold.
Yeah.
Playing his cello.
Roll call, Suprema.
Oh, damn it, Steve, I hate you, man.
Suprema, roll call. Suprema, Suprema, roll call.
My name's Boss Bill.
Yeah.
Just here to say hello.
Yeah.
And I'm feeling great.
Yeah.
Mellow as a cello.
Roll call, Suprema.
Yes, I can't do my cello.
Suprema, roll call. Suprema, Suprema, roll call.
It's La Ia.
Yeah.
And my boo, Larry Gold.
Yeah.
My favorite Tough Jew.
Yeah.
That never gets old.
Roll call.
Suprema.
Suprema roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call.
They say I play the cello.
Yeah.
I'm a very nice fellow, but I'm not. I'm last name Gold, and I'm very bold.
Suprema. Suprema roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call.
See, was that really? Was
it was a bit intimidating, especially with all the cello shit. Everybody used cello. You know, the first, it flashed through my head. You know, cello. I mean, I don't know.
You rhyme a lot with Larry Gold, as you did the word mold.
Bold.
Oh, bold. Yeah, okay. See, there you go.
Bold. I was going to leave that go, even though she could have gone that way.
Right. Okay. My favorite part of taping this podcast is when guests of the show start expressing fear when I tell them 2 minutes ahead of time that they're about to start. We never, of course, you know, we never tell the guest that they're doing the freestyle.
Ladies, Laia was looking at her phone.
Oh, we know.
Oh, yeah. That's
you,
right.
Know, you don't know. Yeah. Okay. We, yeah, see, yeah. This lets us know, like, you know, your enthusiasm for doing the show. Like, you know, well, you're there. We'll give you an 8.
It definitely is intimidating.
You got an 8. You're good, man. You're good.
8? Fuck, I didn't get that in school.
See? You got an 8. You got an 8. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Questlove Supreme. I'm your host, Questlove, and we're here with Team Supreme. Fine, Tickalo, and
yeah.
Sugar Steve,
and hey.
Boss Bill,
hello,
and Laia, how you doing? Mm-hmm. We're man down now.
Steve is happy about this. Unpaid bill, he didn't make it.
I think that we might have affected two of our guests with the Questlove Supreme diet here.
Yeah.
So we fed unpaid bill. He had impossible cheesesteaks. He had some drink. He had some David's chicken from Chinatown.
Mm-hmm. And this is all in the same night.
And had more drink. And now he's out of commission. So I think
Fonta had a rough morning too, I heard.
Yeah, it was pretty. Yeah, we went to
you
the.
Too?
Where did we go? It wasn't
we
too bad.
We went to Barclay Prime.
We went to Barclay Prime.
Philly shit.
And I had a ribeye and the truffle mac and cheese.
Yeah.
And the mac and cheese, it came back to say what's up.
Really?
Yeah, it was.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I haven't. I mean, really, really rich dairy shit.
Right.
It was good, but yeah, this morning it reminded me.
But do y'all hear that? That's the dopeness of the Philly, because that's all Philly food. That's like Bill got fucked up. He couldn't take it. Fonte got fucked up. He couldn't take it.
Well, and I'm from North Carolina.
But y'all ate it because it was good as hell.
Yeah, you know what I mean? It was good.
That's why I went to McDonald's.
Damn.
In Philly.
Well, actually, that speaks more about me. Like, I'm killing all of our hosts here.
Hey, man. We all got to go sometime, you know?
We're all your choices.
So. Oh, Lord. Ladies and gentlemen, so let's say that you remember that moment where you were in your feelings when you first heard those strings on Love My Life when things fall apart?
Yeah.
That rush you felt like, whoa, the roots are growing up here, and I might be cutting onions. I don't know. Our next guest today, I'll say, has his feet planted in the history of Philadelphia and also the future of Philadelphia. Is an integral part of the foundation of what we know as the Sound of Philadelphia. Of course, if you're familiar with the any of the works from the Sound of Philadelphia, be it Gamble and Huff Creations or even things produced by Tom Moulton or
Tom Bell.
Yeah, Tom Bell or any of the Sound of Philadelphia luminaries, Dexter Wansdale, whoever.
Baker Harris Young.
Yes.
McFadden and
Whitehead. Just the secret sauce, the special sauce of the Sound of Philadelphia, I will say, are the less strings. It gives a touch of class a step further than what I think Berry Gordy thought he was doing with the Motown sound, trying to make it palatable to America. And our guest today was a part of that. But not only that, we can also say that he had his hand in the second resurgence of the Sound of Philadelphia as owner of the much fabled the studio here in what part of town are we?
Is Northern,
Northern Liberties?
Liberties?
Okay.
Yeah,
we'll call it Northern Liberties.
Or North Chinatown.
Okay.
Which I prefer, but
North Chinatown, Northern Liberties. And at this very studio, I will say that pretty much any and everybody, this is where I first met the great Bruce Swedien.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's right.
When he was doing Jennifer Lopez's vocals. Wow. Yeah, but this has been home to the roots for at least 10 albums. It's a list. And not to mention, you've done string arrangements for everyone.
Justin Timberlake.
Timberlake.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've done good.
You've done good. Ladies and gentlemen, he's done good for himself. Larry Cole.
Yes,
see? How you doing, man?
Thank you. I'm fine.
I was trying to figure out when did we first cross paths.
I remember.
My version of the story was, well, I know that Fatine Dantzler, Daddy Kendrick, told me about the studio. But at that time, you know, I was married to the sound and setup that I had at Sigma.
Right.
Both of our old homes.
Well.
And then an incident happened.
Right. That's what I remember. An right. incident happened, and James Poyser called me.
Yeah, so an incident happened without putting out the business of one of the former members of the Roots.
No,
we've made no bones about our feelings about Malik's situation. Much love to Malik B. But an incident happened at the studio that kind of got us all kicked out. It got us all kicked out. Well, here's the thing, though.
Sort of overnight, too, as well.
It was instantly. Yeah. And for me, I kind of played the sentimental card. You remember in Chris Tucker's Money Talks when he was sort of like, what would our mom say, man? Come on, pity pat.
Yeah, yeah,
we're right. Back. Come on, man. What would our mama say? Like, it was that situation with me and Joe Tarsia, the owner of Sigma. Oh, he was like, get them out. I don't want them back here. And I was just like, come on, man. You know my daddy. And my plea was like, at least I didn't want an inconsistent sound. Like, I recorded 70% of the album.
Finish, yeah.
Right. I made 70% of the music in Sigma, and I wanted a consistent sound throughout. So he was like, all right. Well, I'll let you guys track the music here, but, you know, Malik vocals can never come back here. So so thus, all the vocals were then done here in this very room that we're in.
Wow.
So I'll say that adrenaline, all of side two almost.
It was all done
adrenaline,
here.
Adrenaline, you got me.
Side two, what's that?
I'm sorry, I'm so old. 100% done to you. Yeah. Everything. And then eventually, once we started working on Phrenology, we just moved here.
Stay here.
You know, he made us an offer we couldn't refuse. I think the first song I cut here was the impronounceable
the punk.
Yeah.
the one that fans are still waiting for you to give them the lyrics to.
I gotta find it. It's somewhere in this building. Okay. Whatever it was, I was cussing out D'Angelo, so I'll give you that much. this was 4 days after he stood us up for Break You Off.
Oh, so, wow.
I remember that night.
Yeah. I think one of the lines I remember is, meanwhile, your hero's running scared.
Oh, wow.
Some
shots.
Like, oh, no. It was a diss track for your ass, man. Anyway, Larry, how you doing, bro?
All right.
I'm sorry. Anyway, how's it going, Larry?
Well.
Yes, well. It's going well.
Yeah.
Are you a Philadelphia native? Did you?
Yeah, I grew up a few blocks from here in North Philly.
Really?
Yeah. My dad had a toy store, little, you know, toy and hardware store, and we grew upstairs.
Really? Yeah. What part of N-O-R-T-H or N-O-R-F?
The 2900 block of Frankfurt Avenue, which is the heroin district right now in Philadelphia. Mm. It's real hardcore.
Really?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I...
let's put it this way. I had many cellos cracked open on the way home from the elevated.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I had to run home sometimes.
Carrying
the cello.
Wow. So it's always been... I guess we should note that I had to find out through a New York Times story that, I guess you could say, the Kensington section or...
Yeah, it is. It's the Kensington section. Even though there's a whole group of 20-year-olds now moving... further north than where you guys were when you were last.
Well, Fishtown is becoming gentrified.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah,
gracious.
They try to sell me a crib there for a lot of money. No. Fishtown is gentrified, right. Which, like, 30 years ago, Fishtown was sort of like Bensonhurst.
It was good. Wow.
Oh, yeah, that's the only place in the world I've ever been called a nigger.
Yes.
In Fishtown?
Yeah.
Fishtown. Driving down the street. Like 30 years ago, it was some Bensonhurst.
In Kensington, I'm not surprised.
Well, yeah.
I mean,
I was.
And now, like, some of the world's best restaurants and, you know, Stephen's. Like, it's upscale. However, further north, northeast of there, in Kensington, Philly's like getting hit with its third wave of, you know, we had
heroin,
a little
opioid, whatever.
Yeah, we had a thing like in 2006.
I think we have the worst problem right now of any of the major cities.
We are.
I really.
Yeah, because I was like, what
you know,
are
I think we've hit a low point in town here right now. You know, the school system sucks. Yeah. You know, I mean, we're. No, you know, the property culture. Taxes are so high that you can't really raise them anymore without people suffering. You know, I mean, it's, you know, time to deal with the cities again, you know, to take a good look at everything. You know, I mean, yeah. Hey, It's people insane. Aren't getting an even break, you know, and that's the thing. Yeah.
Ain't gonna get easy.
I feel like we have to come back now.
And,
well, I mean, that was kind of the solution before. It was like, nothing's happened in this town. Hey, let's make something happen. And
well, you did.
You know.
You did.
I don't know if that's going to save that. That's my little kumbaya.
You represented Philly music for a period of time. I remember early in the 90s, when you guys were first starting, one of the big executives said to me, have you heard The Roots? And I said, The Roots? Yeah, he said, they're from Philly. And I felt like an ignorant son of a fool, you know? I had not heard of them. And then I remember you played Columbia's freshman party, and my daughter went to see you when she was a freshman there. And she called me on the phone and said, they're extraordinary.
Wow.
You know, Dad,
wow.
You got to go introduce them. Introduce
high
yourself.
High marks coming from her.
You know, and so you guys were representing Philadelphia long before Neo Soul.
Wow. Thank you. I appreciate that. So where does your musical introduction start? Like, how did you, were your plans? Were your plans to be like a Curtis Institute?
Yeah, classical cellist. Early on, I got caught by the fever of popular music, though, really as a kid. So
how did you ease out of that? And did you disappoint people when you told? Okay, explain. Well, first of all, can you explain, a lot of people hold Juilliard in the highlight of like, okay, well, that's the pinnacle of music education for classical music. But can you explain how hard, and I think Curtis has a way harder curriculum.
So it's not particularly a curriculum. It's just Curtis has always been about, when I was there were 75 kids. Now there's about 150.
Uh-huh.
Juilliard, there's thousands that take lessons.
Right.
You know, it's a different kind of entity, you know? I mean, Curtis might be up to 200 by now. I don't know. They built a new building and they got a lot of money. And it was a very private school.
Yeah, Curtis is.
It's in Philadelphia.
Okay. Way harder to get into Curtis than for me, at least. Like I saw the audition, I failed that.
And
audition.
This is a performing arts school, or is it like a conservatory?
Yeah, it's a conservatory, okay. but it's performing arts, mostly instrumental arts. Gotcha. You know, it's now operatic and a lot of other things. And I think they're teaching improvisation starting next year. They brought somebody in, and I think they're going to, like everyone else in this world, things have changed since the 60s. In the 60s, you were put in a box. If you got out of that box, nobody knew what to do with you. You know, I mean, it was like, it was a weird time. You know, when I wanted to be in popular music and classical music, that wasn't even really possible in the early 60s.
What year did you attend, Curtis?
I was 15, so that would have been 1963.
So by this point, are you seeing your other peers?
I was already making a little bit of a living. I met some of the, in those days, the union in Philadelphia was run by, you know, South Philly musicians. And that's the nicest way I could say. There, you know, back in
you mean some friends of ours?
Yes.
Yeah.
Some, you know, back, all right. Back in the early 60s, I made a when I first started playing on records,
uh-huh.
I made a brilliant discovery. There was a white union and a black union.
I did not know that.
Well, I'm telling you that. And Mr. Gambo, I know, was here yesterday. Kenny was here yesterday. He would have told you that, which I found amazing. And don't know much about it, but I know that by the time the mid-60s rolled around, they formed one union.
Okay.
Okay, so I would say, I think 66 or something like that, there was one union.
Technically, I'm a union guy.
Yeah, I know.
But I never go to the meetings and...
No, I know.
Who does the union benefit?
Well, in the old days, it was a real sort of like mob kind of a thing, because they would go into a restaurant, and if you had live musicians, they would make sure they were union players. So, I mean,
so
if you go back,
to collect.
Yeah, exactly. If you go back to the 20s and the 30s and the 40s, yeah, it was a way to collect dues, a way to have easy jobs, you know? I mean, then a way to make sure your musician union people were represented in these clubs or these places. I always thought I think the union's a good thing, because I think people take advantage of other people without them at times.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. But I also think that the union gets too, like,
anal retentive?
Yes.
I felt okay. So in doing the,
we both know that.
So in doing the Hamilton recording, this is when I knew, like, oh god, man, these union people get on my nerves. Like, they literally have a person over your shoulder micromanaging with a stopwatch.
Yeah,
and it's like they're always reminding you, like, T-minus 3 hours and 19 minutes, folks. And it's like, yo, can we get rid of this person? But then it'll get down to, like, they'll say T-minus 9 minutes before a first 20-minute break. And they have to make this loud declaration no matter what you're doing. It blows the vibe. But, like, their job is there to protect. But then I found out, once you speak to maybe a label president or whatever and you slide some squirrel or whatever, then maybe they could just sit in the break room or whatever. Like, this happens with, like, the cast albums I've worked on. So I realized that, okay, maybe to protect you so that, you know, I don't underpay you or that sort of thing, you join the union, then of course I have to pay you union scale or double scale or triple scale or whatever your price is. So I see that benefit, but,
and it goes into your health insurance. How
about this? Yeah, and also supposedly, you know, here we are talking about this is bullshit, but I mean, and supposedly, like, I'm on a pension from
your
them,
pension, yeah.
But
yeah,
they're fucking around with the pension, man. You know, I mean, so I don't know what to say about all these people.
But from a non-union perspective, union just looks like heaven. I'm just going to tell you, like, all my life, I mean, even in
get a black, tambourine,
like, black radio get has never tambourine. Been unionized. Like, it's a whole thing. So it's like, I've always looked at y'all like, wow, protection, stability.
Well, some of it's good. Yeah. You know, I mean,
I see. Do you remember the first professional gig that you did in a studio?
I don't. I knew you were going to ask me this, and I really, it was, you know, one, it was like Cameo and Parkway. It was probably in 1963 or before, 62. Okay. And I started playing on records. Whenever they used two cellos, there used to be, I guess it was like maybe four violins, one viola, one cello. Then they expanded. They went six violins, two violas, two cellos. So as soon as they did that, the head guy took a liking to me. He was a really good jazz violin player. Mm-hmm. He grew up legit, but he was more like Joe Venuti. He had a real sort of that sound, you know, that right. Most legit players have a great sound, but it's more formal.
Okay.
His was much looser. I liked him. He was a great guy. His name was Dom Rinaldo. He's on every record Gamble Enough ever made, Dom Rinaldo Strings and Horns.
Oh, okay.
Well, Dom Rinaldo.
That was the name of the?
Of the strings and horns.
Oh.
In other words, it always said none of our individual names.
Right.
It was Don Rinaldo's Strings and Horns. So he was an executive at the union. He got me into the union. I was probably 14 or something. You were supposed to be 16.
Okay.
And he started getting me gigs.
Okay. This is something that I should know that I don't know. Can you explain the difference between the violin, the viola, and the cello, and the
bass?
Yes, the bass.
Okay. So those four string instruments, the bass starts, the first string on the bass, the lowest string is like an E. Low E on the piano. Right. Low E on the piano. The lowest string on the cello is a C above that.
C.
Right. A C above that.
Okay.
The next on the viola, the lowest string is an octave above that cello C. A C.
C.
Right. Then on the violin, the lowest string is the G above that C, which is the G below middle C.
G.
Yeah.
Okay. And so
it's
there's
like
a different range of...
It encompasses the whole bottom of the piano and the whole top of the piano. The violin goes from that G almost to the end of the piano.
Okay.
A great violinist can go all the way to the end.
So violin has more range. Yeah. Viola has half the range.
No, but viola can go very high too, but not as high sounding as the violin. It would be an octave under the violin, even at its highest.
Oh, okay. Okay. Okay.
So the violin gets up where the birdies go.
So what we know as the sound of Philadelphia?
Was mostly six violins, two violas, two cellos, doubled. And sometimes we performed it.
That kills me.
Sometimes we performed it three times. And the best takes were, you know, I mean, you didn't have, you see, you didn't have the luxury in those days of like, you had to know you had a good performance and then you doubled it onto two. You in the early days with 16 track or 8 track, you had to already bounce it to move it.
Ooh.
Double it. So you had to have a good track to begin with, and then you were going, taking that old track and the new track, the old track out of phase and the new track.
Moving them together.
Yeah, moving them together.
Is there a risk that, I didn't notice
that? You know what? It would be naturally out of phase because it was two different performances, too. Mm-hmm. You know, right. No two performances are exactly the same. So there wouldn't be like...
But is there a risk of, say, maybe the bass is now out of tune and his A is slightly off and now that's messing up the song?
Yeah, there's always that risk. And a lot of times, if you go listen to the strings, they're out of tune.
Really?
You know, but yet, so are the vocals. A lot of that stuff's a little bit out of tune. You know that. But it all works together in the song. But a lot of times you're listening solos, so if it's out of tune, you do it again. I'm here.
So
you might end up doing your double a couple of more times than you would. But people compromised much easier back in those days. They were just looking for a feel on those records. It was more short. They were elegant and there were certain producers that wanted it pristine. You take someone like Burt Bacharach, who came into the city a few times, you know, and everything had to be precise and exact, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. But there were an awful lot of people that was not the case. They were like unmade beds, you know, they would, as soon as they got the feel of the record right, that was it. They didn't care what was in tune or attitude.
Right. As long as it felt right.
As long as it felt right.
So you're trying to tell me, I'm trying to think of, okay, so like Stairway to Heaven.
That's already 24 track or 16, 24 track.
But even you're.
And like we're talking OJ's, not Led Zeppelin.
Yeah, OJ's. Yeah. Stairway to Heaven.
I had nothing to do with Led Zeppelin.
Just but, for those listening.
A song like Stairway to Heaven that I, when I hear it, I'm just imagining it's 50 of you in a room doing these strings. And it's really just 12, 14.
Well, it's 10 doubled.
Damn. Yeah.
So the first...
See, Phil Ramone couldn't get over that's what it was, too.
I can't get over it now.
You know what? I always had my problems with Joe Tarzia, but I have to say he was a fucking good engineer.
Really?
Yeah. Ooh. You know, I always thought they were a little bit too aggressive for me. And maybe, you know, maybe other people felt that way, you know, just as people in a way. When I lived
aggressive, like, don't move the microphones.
No. Just aggressive as people.
Oh, okay.
You know, I mean, they didn't fit into my hippie self, you know. They rubbed me the wrong way a little bit.
Oh, okay.
But he was a great fucking engineer. They made great records there. He taught a lot of my friends how to make magnificent, you know, records, you know, Donald Murray, who did all those Spinners records, and, mm-hmm. you know, some of the young people eventually did some of the records we all know as the Philly Sound. Right. Joe sat next to Gamble making his records, you know.
Right.
So those, Stairway, that was Joe Tarzia's Stairway mm-hmm. to Heaven. And he had a slate floor at 309 that he put the strings on the slate floor, so he was getting a lot of bounce out of the sound of the strings.
So strings would be cut on 309 Broad Street at
a lot of times, yeah. Because they realized that, first of all, it was right next door to where Kenny and Leon lived mostly, which their offices were.
Right,
And where they wrote the songs. So, and here they built a really nice studio that, you know, was for the 70s was sort of state of the art. It had shag carpet. You know, a lot of the studios in the 70s were like that. Right. And it had a slate floor and hardwood. And it had a real live sound off the floor. But then when it hit the walls, it was pretty dead. Like they had the drums right. They cut a lot of the drum tracks over there.
See, in my mind, I thought they were cutting upstairs in the Sigma room.
Not a lot. Not by the time they built 309. Okay. Now, I wish Kenny was here, but I think in 1973 he opened 309 South Broad, mm-hmm. which was already a recording studio when it opened up. There was a record. First of all, that was where Cameo and Parkway had an enormous studio, three times the size of this room.
Wow.
that was when the early days when I first went in to make a record, there were 32 or 34 musicians and singers in the room at the same time. The strings were in one corner, the horns were in another corner, the rhythm was all in the center.
Tracking all at once.
Tracking all at once.
How do you, when you record that way, and this is before overdubbing.
We used to do that sometimes with MFSB too, but that was in a much smaller room. This was a big room.
And that's because you can't overdub and add later, but how many times would you have to go over a song so that the engineer makes sure, I mean, so the engineer can ensure that they have a perfect performance?
I think when I was there, it seemed like the engineers were very efficient getting a sound out of all of these musicians at one time. You know, it might have taken an hour to get the sound, and then they might have recorded a couple of songs.
So you might have to run the song four or five times, yeah, just to get...
Six times. But, you know, I mean, they were miking most of the amps. The guitar was, you know, there were, I don't think, direct boxes. I even think Joe Tarzi invented a direct box that was used all over the world after that, you know, late 60s.
Like, we got to get Joe Tarzi.
I knew you was about to say that.
On the show.
You're right.
He should be here now. Oh, I'm sorry, Steve, I interrupted you.
No, I was just wondering, so like, let's say the first set of horns and strings, just the two tracks?
Well, it all went down to two track, like an Ampex two track. Okay. Or a Scully. This is like the best of my recollection. Okay. So, besides playing and everything, I was already an audio freak. My father had bought me the first Webcore portable tape recorder that I was turning over. I was already fascinated by popular music all through this whole time. I wasn't going to give up at Curtis because getting in the Curtis was my main goal, you know, so. But I was fascinated by popular music. And I was watching these guys and yeah, they had it down to a science, man. They really did. They were fast, efficient.
But it's not like they were miking each instrument like we do now, what they like did, with like, its own track.
With the strings, there was one mic for three violins, another mic for three violins. The cellos had separate mics, and right, the viola had one mic. So that's the way those were mic'd.
And then, but when it went and to tape,
when it went to horns, you had all ribbon mics on the horns. Yeah, each horn had a mic. Yeah, when they played a chord, the engineer had to get a balance on the chord. Yeah, and the strings too, and they had to run it down enough times where the engineer felt comfortable. But they were also, you know, they're also singing live. They might not sing at the time we did the tracking in those early days, because what they did was then they went to another machine to put the vocals on. Mm-hmm. They took the instrumental and went to the second machine and laid down the lead vocal on the background vocals so they could put them way out front. And if you listen to some of those old records, the vocals are like this compared to the music. I mean, they're way out front.
How would they add the, I guess, the, okay, there's the string section, but then there's also, what do you call them, chamber or like the sousaphones and the trumpets and the...
They were all there live too. If you were going down the two track, there was the only overdubs I think they did early on were vocals to another machine.
So the strings and all the horns would be tracked, yeah, at the same time?
And that's why they had big studios in those days. They'd baffle things off.
I was going to say the bleeding must have been horrible for an engineer, though.
But they got an overall sound. In other words, if you listen to some of those records, they made them bigger, Amir, because everyone was in the same room. Because the strings had some horns in them. The horns had some strings in them. The guitar, you know what I'm saying? Everybody had a lot of all the other elements, sort of. I mean, you tried to do the best you could, isolate things, but it was impossible to isolate things.
That's like the ultimate restriction. It's just like you have to record everything at the same exact time.
Yeah, that's too much pressure.
It was pressure.
Well, I'm just used to, I mean, I've made complete records that sound like, you know, it's ensembles gelling together and, you know.
But when you do
and it, I'm just playing drums by myself for like 10 minutes, imagining what it's going to sound like later and that sort of thing. But, I can't even imagine that.
But like when you did the Hamilton record, that's everybody all together too, wasn't it? Or did you do that in parts?
No, that all the rhythm tracks were done together. And then, yes, they all.
Right.
They did, but then in the middle of it, I guess we realized that this is going to be Thriller. Like, there was a point where it was just like, okay, Hamilton, it's whatever. Like,
right.
Just record it top to bottom, that sort of thing. But then...
Which is the way Broadway cast albums are usually done.
Yeah, but then there was one point where it was like, okay, they might have to spend more money. And that's the thing. Like, Atlantic Records realized early that this could change the game. Mm-hmm. And so they were like, okay, we're willing to invest more money in this and mix each individual song. And that, you know, any other Broadway record, like in 14 album hours, like you spend 5 hours tracking, 3 hours over dubbing, and then, you know, it's just one big giant mix and then that's it. But we spent 3 to 4 months mixing and really sweetening up that record.
Yo, what's up? This is Fonsigolo from Team Supreme. Black representation in media is very important to me. I think it's important to have our stories told by people who look like us and who have shared in our common experiences. Some of my earliest influences were Donnie Simpson. I would also say Tom Joyner, Angela Stribling, Sherry Carter. They were just people who told our stories with a lot of class and dignity and were big inspirations to me. The next generation of influential Black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black Stories, Black Truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcast, The Center Black Voices. It's NPR Noir. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get podcasts.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at Airbnb.com/host.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work and traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
That it still sounds like the sound of Philadelphia, even though different people are at the helm. So there are songs that Norman Harris produced that had nothing to do with Gamble and Huff, that still use the same players, that still use the same studios, and you can't tell a difference.
But know? They were part of the original Gamble and Huff sound to begin with, though. You picked the name Norman Harris,
right?
Was definitely part of that original rhythm section. You go back and name a song, an early Gamble and Huff song, and it was either Roland Chambers. Mm-hmm. He was in a group with the Chambers. One of them played drums and the other one played guitar. I think Dennis was his name. I'm really digging deep, you know. And make a long story short, I think Norman Harris played on a lot of those records. So he was part of that sound. And he was also, Norman Harris was like a genius R&B dude.
But how many, I'm trying to figure out teams, because this is another thing that you see on credits. You'll see string arranger, rhythm arranger.
Right.
Background vocal arranger.
Right.
Which I feel like these are like little titles handed out from the producer so that no one has to, so that they, the producer can protect their turf and
in a way,
not
that's
share credit.
That's true.
So, it's all right. So, when you're dealing with, okay, so someone brings, used to be my girl, the OJs. I'm assuming that the rhythm track is done first.
I don't exactly know for sure.
Well, I mean,
but wait a minute.
For typical.
If I'm not mistaken, that song was done with the old rhythm section.
Okay.
So it was Norman and Ronnie and Leon and I left somebody out. I'm sorry.
Oh, you're getting specific. I just wanted to know the factory process. So it starts with the rhythm tracks first.
Right. And then vocals.
Okay.
After that.
Oh, the rhythm track, then the vocals.
Vocals. And then strings and horns.
Okay. So then someone gives a tape to... Who would do the actual writing of what...
After the vocal...
What Gamble and Huff want string-wise on
them? After the vocals were done, a cassette was handed to somebody, and they went home and wrote an arrangement. With no machines, you used the piano, and you came up with lines, or you came up with chordal things, you know, and you wrote string and horn parts.
How many days do you have to do this?
It depended. Sometimes I did it in the studio at times when they added a song or two, you know. I mean, they would forget. I mean, Dexter did it at times in the studio, too. Not the best way to do it, but, yeah, it would maybe a week. You know, you might have... Five days to a week to do a couple of arrangements.
Do you have a particular memorable favorite of yours that you worked on? That day? Yeah, back in that day,
McFadden and Whitehead really gave me the opportunity. I think they hired an arranger who didn't show up one day. And I think Tommy Bell was around and Tommy said, you know, let Larry try it. You know,
really?
Yeah. I think Tommy said... Because I think Tommy was a little upset that they were hiring people that he didn't think really knew what they were doing at times. You know, I mean, but he could answer you better than I can.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, how can you...
You know, because, you know, you could, someone who can come up with... Hey, look, it's like all I do is write strings, okay? Most of my life, that's all I did. And when I work on a record, sometimes people give me a string line. And when people give me a string line... It's going to be hard for me to leave that string line go away.
Right.
Because, first of all, they liked it enough
that's
to give it
like
to me.
It, yeah.
Yeah, I mean.
They're married
with
to
it. They might be married to it. Well, sometimes that happened with Gamble and Huff, you know, with Edwin McFadden and White. They were married to something, and they would tell me that, you know. And a lot of times in today's market, I get it, and I have to deal with it. And a lot of times I think I can do better, and I throw away, and I hopefully do better, you know.
How does one... I was about to say, at least in the 70s and 80s, there's a lot of trust that one has to put in an arranger, because it's not like you have the technology today to play on synthesizer or whatever that what you have planned for me. So it's almost like I have to sit there in real time
That's
and listen
what it was.
To you. You know, so if ain't no stoppin' us now comes on.
The producer came out into the studio, and you had your string players there, and they put earphones on like we have.
All right, play me what you got.
You play me what you got. Let me how good it is, Goldie. Let's see what you did.
So
Has
there ever been a case where an arranger had something, and they were sort of like, it's a little too Stravinsky for me. Like, you went darker. Like, how do you know?
Well, in the Philly sound, I don't know whether Stravinsky played in too much.
Okay,
you know?
Well, let's pick something adventurous. All right, so let's take Nights Over Egypt, which has quite an adventurous beginning, at least.
Progression.
Yeah, in the first 30 seconds. So.
That's Dexter.
He wrote the arrangements, too?
I think so, yeah.
Oh, okay. I didn't think that the actual producer.
I think that's Dexter. Yeah. Dexter wrote his own screenplay.
Him and Cynthia Biggs.
I want to tell you something. Back in the day, Ronnie Baker wrote string arrangements. Norman Harris was brilliant, wrote great string arrangements. Earl didn't, but everybody else, Ronnie Kersey wrote good arrangements. Everybody sort of did. Everybody grew up writing music from high school, you know? Everybody got into, you know, had that as a skill. So, I mean, and I learned a lot. Hey, look, man, the best arranger ever passed through Philadelphia. I think he's dead now, but it was Bobby Martin, who was an old school from the 30s arranger, you know, who played vibes, you know. I mean,
I know Bobby's name well. Right. Yeah. On an average week, how often would you work?
A couple of days. It depends. During the disco times, it was like 4 days a week, maybe 5 days a week.
So was that living in Philadelphia?
Oh, yeah, really good. From people from all over the world, though. You know, I mean, we did, people don't realize this, but we did like all of Jacques Morali's records, YMCA.
What?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
That's MFSB.
What?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Non-credited, the Ritchie family was MFSB.
Ritchie family, yeah. Ritchie.
They're from Philly, too.
Yeah.
But, okay, so...
Yeah, and Jacques Morali. Okay, Jacques Morali. I remember, you know, I mean, my memory is good when I want it to be and not so good when I, obviously, when I don't want it to be. But I remember there was a some fancy Paris nightclub where they danced naked. And it was the high point of disco music. And this guy named, I think, Benalil or something, and Jacques Morali was the producers, and they brought over, and they did, the first records they did was with Ritchie Rome, and it was called The Ritchie Family.
Right.
And it was MFSB, you know, done with their melodies that they brought in, a little more European flair, and that Ritchie did for them, and they put vocals on them, and they did pretty good, and then the next group I think they came back with, after they had a lot of success with that, was The Village People.
Wow.
You know, and I remember they came to Philly and they had a suitcase full of cash. Back in those days. Some of these people, literally a suitcase full of cash to pay the musicians.
Really?
Yeah.
Step in our office, here you go. Step in our office,
yeah,
here you
it was,
go.
It, but that was not talking about non-union work.
Right.
What other non-Philadelphia International projects were you part of? That are on that calendar.
Oh, there were a lot of things. I mean, for a while there, Norman Harris was working for Motown. So if you go back and look at some of those records in the mid-70s through the late end of the 70s, I don't know whether it was maybe the Temps, the Four Tops, some of those records. We did a bunch of those records, too.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. It's amazing. Now
well, it's not so. Not
my main
so,
is my brain is racing.
You know, if you think about it, I think Barry Gordy wanted to pick up on Philly was really kicking butt then. You know, those mid 70 years to the late years. I mean, it's hard to find a place that sold more records than Philly International.
Nah, straight up.
Do you guys recall doing any work with Bernard Wright and Nile Rodgers,
nope.
The Chic people at all?
Nope. I went to Power.
Oh, what did I say?
Right.
Yeah, you did it.
Oh, I'm sorry. Bernard Edwards.
I went to Power Station to play on a few things, but I'm not going to remember the name.
Okay. We took Power Station is Nile's headquarters.
We took a bus there, and all MFSB played all day. Maybe one or two days, and we came home, and I don't remember what record it was for.
Oh, okay.
I also smoked a lot of pot on that little day, which I always do, and we all know that. So
you're a hippie, man. I get it. Yeah. When is there a particular date that you can pinpoint that you noticed, like okay, this might be an end of an era, or we're not being used as much, or Yamaha DX7 is now, like the synthesizers are coming in?
Guess what? You just did the top three right there. You know, oh, wow. The Yamaha was definitely a
problem.
Yeah, well, it wasn't a problem, but I started getting calls for some arranging, and when they would ask me if I would use the Yamaha, the D7, was it? What was
DX7.
It? DX7, to use them for the strings instead of paying the string players.
Wow.
And I thought to myself, oi, you know,
blasphemy.
This is, and that was like, you know, it was sort of getting into the late 70s when I felt like it was curtailing. And plus, the records started sucking, too. A lot of the records weren't nearly as good. I was not looking forward to go to work and you're boom, boom.
Yeah.
You know, all day long, you know. I mean, so, but it was making a living, you know. And I started looking around at that moment at the end of the 70s. I mean, even Gamble will tell you, I started working for Sesame Street towards the end of the 70s.
Really?
Yeah. I found a few people that I connected with. As a matter of fact, the gentleman here yesterday, yeah. He and I had a nice conversation.
Wow. Yeah. You knew that. You playing on the Disco Frog. I did not know that.
Yeah, I thought you did. Remember, we one time discussed, I did Teeny Little Super Guy.
Oh, what?
Yeah, I thought you remembered that.
Oh, my God.
That was done in Philly.
Yo, dude, I just turned into an 8-year-old.
Me too.
Yo!
You got to find it.
That was Esther Mohawk who did the theme for Teeny Little Super, who was an old hippie who was signed by Frank Zappa back in the 60s.
Oh, man.
That's crazy.
That's what we did. Started doing in the tail end of the 70s through the 80s. We did, Jerry and I, first of all, we were friends from early on. I knew him when he was playing with Frankie Beverly in the 60s a little bit. He was a hippie and great keyboard player.
Okay.
And yeah, and we all through the 80s, we were at Sigma and we did a lot of commercials. We did a lot of different things.
I was going to say, did you do any like the local?
Oh, yeah, all of them. A lot of
Philly
them.
Stuff, the Action News.
Well, I actually know what I'm working on right now? KYW.
The new thing.
I'm doing a big orchestral arrangement for KYW, the news.
They're upgrading?
Radio. Yeah.
So it's the new In and Out? Like the everyday?
No, it's the same KYW, but I news mean, it's just. Someone else wrote something where I'm going to put the strings on. Ooh. But we did like New Jersey Transit. I mean, I used to get like Bunny Sigler to sing. I did one commercial with Lou Rawls sang. I mean, I had a good time with it and people were willing to pay decent money in those days. And
did you do
and let me smoke reefer in the studio. So
what?
I was cool.
That's
with
what's
it.
Most important. You know.
When did you decide to establish your own business and open up a studio? And what told you that Phil, you needed one?
Well, the 80s were, as you well know, in I went from doing all of that in the 70s to having nothing left of Gamble and Huff. I mean, they sort of just shut down completely. Mm-hmm.
But they'd never... They did, but they didn't.
But they didn't.
It was always there. It's just nobody was productive.
To make one record a year you couldn't count on that to make a living like we did for a while. I mean, there were a lot of people that did real well, and you counted on it to make a living. So, it in a way, to me, it did shut down. And what happened was the 80s, as you guys know far better than I do. I've just been on the journey of black music, but rap started.
And then rap.
And then rap started. Okay. And I happened to be, okay. We were doing this stuff with the Sesame Street. We were doing okay. And all of a sudden, this artificial intelligent music thing started appearing and more readily. I mean, drum machines, we always bought whatever was new and tried around. And we would fool around with it. And even the DX7, we had it. I remember sitting in the living room when I was playing the string sounds and said, they're kidding me, aren't they? Mm-hmm. You know, thinking that all you could do was these heavenly pads, you know, which is okay, but every record going to have heavenly pads on it, you know? I mean,
in the 80s? Yes.
Yeah.
So make a long story short, Jerry and I ended up moving with Studio 4 early on. And they ended up starting to do more rap, and I met Lawrence Goodman. I think Kenny actually told Lawrence Goodman to introduce himself to me, and he came to Sigma. We were still at Sigma, and he was tired. Okay, he'd have to tell you himself, but I think that he wasn't getting any publishing royalties, and he wanted to know if Jerry and I could copy some. He would bring a record and say, can you make something that sounds like this? You know, for work for hire. You know?
Really?
Oh, yeah. So I think we did that for a little while for him at Sigma. And then we moved. We left and went somewhere else. And, yeah, we went to Victory. What was it
Victory.
Called?
Victory. Or Cajun.
Yeah, or Cajun. Mm-hmm. And we started them. We did Steady B and Cool C. We did a whole bunch of albums there with them. You know, was a living.
Synth arrangements or?
Yeah. Synclavier arrangements. I bought a synclavier in like 83 or 84. Oh, I took the Sesame, I took some of the monies and borrowed money at the bank. Somebody co-signed the loan for me. And I bought that fucking expensive thing, man.
I'm willing to bet, he might not remember, I'm willing to bet. So since back when Salt and Pepper were Supernature, and
they were at Studio 4. You got it, I'm here.
I bet you that they commissioned them to play the Revenge of the Nerds. All right, so you remember their first record was the Showstopper.
Yeah.
And their music was the Revenge of the Nerds song. I'm almost willing to bet, because all the credits on the Showstopper says it was done at Studio 4 and on a synclavier. So
yeah, well, that was my synclavier on the Studio.
I'm almost willing to bet.
How did the synclavier work?
Yeah, but except you got to understand that, you know, hey, look, when I had Jerry as my partner, I didn't even play, really. I mean, I dreamed. I composed like I always had done. But he was a much better keyboard player than I could have ever dreamed to be. Mm-hmm. And so he played. So that was my impetus in even buying it to begin with, because I realized, first of all, we went up to New York. They gave us a morning with it.
Okay.
And he and I, in the morning, we created some pretty hot tracks, you know, just fucking around, you know. We looked at each other, and the bass, you could feel the bass, you know. And, you know, when you had a Lynn drum machine, and somehow this had Simpty, it had all the things that were coming into being at that moment.
So was it like a computer?
It is. I still have it. I still use it to this day.
Oh, wow.
It sounds like shit. But I still,
oh, that's right. That's still you use still it use it to still arrange your...
I still use it.
Wow.
That's from then? That's
it's
crazy.
From then. It's now like 40-some years... no, 30-some years old.
Wow.
Ooh, that's crazy. All right.
The only person I knew was Stevie.
Right.
It was the only person I knew.
But you can't do chords on it, can you?
Yeah.
So it's not monolithic.
It's got 64 voices. It was a genius thing when it was invented, Amir.
So is it a keyboard? Like, what's it?
It's a keyboard.
Like? Okay.
Yeah.
But it just sounds like orchestral.
Yeah. Wow. It comes with orchestral patches. Right.
It's been perfected now beyond belief. But back then, you had to pay a lot of money to get something that sounds.
And also to have memory enough to be able to do it, you know? In other words, to record a song inside a little box, you know?
Right.
I think that back in those days, we had, 8 megs of memory or something, which was unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
A Lynn drum machine had 1 meg.
Yeah, it did. Okay. And
so this was 8.
It was a nightmare.
Right. It was a nightmare. You had to open up the back and move the chip.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And you guys remember? I mean, you had to
I collect them now.
Okay.
But I think I wasn't dependent on it for work. But right. I've talked to enough 80s drummers that, you know, have had nightmares with that machine. You know, moving the chips and that sort of thing.
And keeping it in sync.
Yeah.
Sync was always a problem, even though they said everything.
Bobby Z would tell me nightly, like, this. Saw him start fluctuating faster, you know, that sort of thing. So that was a nightmare for him. So when did the studio open in 1999?
No, the studio opened. When did the Roots come here?
About
98,
yeah.
Okay, so the studio opened 2 years before then. So 96. And why I opened the studio was because I sort of was at that place in Society Hill. I was at Sigma.
Uh-huh.
I thought Sigma was going to go bankrupt because I shouldn't even tell this story, but anyway.
You probably should tell
it. We know.
Make a long story short, I was told to get all my equipment out because I owned my equipment in my room there.
Right.
So I left Sigma. I had to leave over the weekend, sort of. And I moved into what was Cajun, that was bought by another dude.
Who owned Cajun?
Cajun was owned by...
At one point,
I'm not going to remember. He was a really good engineer. When I first opened here, he came here and he got great sound out of this room. He was a really good engineer.
Okay.
And I'm not going to remember. I might, as we continue conversation, conversing, I might remember his
remember
name.
Remember his name, okay.
But I'm not going to remember his
well,
name.
Well, no, at one point...
He was a very good engineer.
At one point, Boyz II Men purchased Cajun.
They did.
Yeah, doing the Do You Want well, More Days, I think, well, we used.
While the, but while these guys owned it, Jazzy moved in there, too. Jeff moved... Somehow well, Jeff ended
Jeff
up...
Jeff had Studio 4 and Cajun.
No, before Studio 4.
Oh, okay.
I think he... And James Poyser I met out there, mm-hmm. and I think that was the early 90s.
Really?
I think so.
Okay.
And I and Victor.
Right. Victor.
They were a touch of jazz out there then.
Right. They were.
And I met them. I did that Whitehead Brothers record. That must have been in the early 90s, and that's when I met James.
Four.
Oh wow!
They did. I'm not a play. I don't want to be a. They took.
I don't want to be a genome.
They took. Yeah, they took Pete Rock's number one Soul Brother baseline.
Yeah, the your feel your pain.
Yeah,
that was feel your pain. They
I
took
knew
the,
yeah. you knew that song.
Nah, I love that song.
But did you know the '86 record?
Nah, I didn't know the '86.
I jumped out my skin.
Oh, it's like on Atlantic or something, right?
I think Philly International had to deal with Manhattan Records. Okay. Capital.
Okay. Yeah, Capital.
It was Kenny and Johnny, the Whitehead brothers.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. And they were the sons of
John Whitehead.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, John Whitehead.
And I've been messing around with them since they were really little.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, really little.
On the low, Kenny. The youngest one is Kenny, right?
Yeah, he would come and hang out at my studio at like 13 years old. So.
So you know the cliche of whenever musicians go in a music store and like store managers forbade them to play like Stairway to Heaven, that sort of thing, or like the opening chords of Purple Haze. Mm-hmm. Like Kenny on the low, he could shred like Hendrix, like. I was like, whoa, this is the Whitehead brother guy? Like, but this is back when he was like 14. Like he was a great guitar shredder, but sort of shrugged it off, like, yeah, you know, whatever.
He was a talented young kid.
He was.
He could play piano really well too. Yeah, I mean we did a whole bunch of records that never came out.
Right.
You know? Gamble, they were signed, you were right, they were signed to that label, and there was that and I don't know how many records I helped through those years, okay? But then they got signed to Motown.
Yeah.
And they started the album in California, and they came back to my studio with maybe one or two songs done. And we ended up doing the rest of the album at the studio with the synclavier.
Wow.
And, yeah, I mean, I think I got associate producer credit on that, which I think, yeah, or co-producer, you know, that was about right. He really, you know, I mean, yeah. And we did that beautiful Black Princess song, which had a beautiful string arrangement on it. And I got so much notice from that, you know, because it was an old Philly kind of song, you know, and Kenny sang it so good.
Yeah, I wore that album out back then.
See, a lot of people did, and I got real notice from that. So you asked me why I opened this place is I knew that I still had a little bit in me to be able to help young kids make good products. You know. So, but you need major talent. Let's face all facts, guys.
Right.
You know, you need good people on every little level.
So I wanted to ask you about that. So in doing the string arrangement, and you have your chair order, if it's like, you know, first viola, second viola, whatever, how important is it? Because, I mean, if you have, I don't know if it's 40 pieces or whatever, how exact does it have to be? Say, the fifth cello is a little out or whatever, I don't know. Like with so many people, how is it that one person can make that big of a difference? Like if you hear someone is a little flat, like can you hear that? Does it really make a difference?
You can
like
hear
that?
It.
Really?
Yeah, sure, you could hear it. Yeah, I mean, you want it to sound mellifluous. I used that word before. You know, you want it to sound organic. I mean, a little bit of here and there, that's all part of life, you know. Mm-hmm. But when something's really whack, you know it's whack.
You can hear it.
You know it. When there's a wrong note, you know, there were arrangements we did, you know, which, you know, some of them I wrote, some of them I didn't write, where I could swear there was just some note rubbing somewhere down the line, you know. But it was all live, you know, and I had to get over it, you know.
Was it, did you have, like, certain favorites that you have in terms of, hey, I need a viola, I know this guy,
yeah,
this girl.
I did for years, and now I'm relying on a younger people now, you know. I'm bringing in, you know, different people, and I still only use, like, maybe, like, this week I'm doing a date for I'm doing a record for some young kid in Indiana, and I'm only using 10 musicians, you know. I still do that, and I double, and sometimes if I want it to be a little even bigger, you know, I'll even triple it, or I'll write another part for it, so that it sounds like it's more than it is.
Gotcha. I was always curious to know about Vince Montana.
Yeah, he was a good friend. He used to come to the studio an awful lot.
Okay,
even this place. In other words, even by the time I opened this place, Ronnie Baker was dead and Norman Harris was dead. Earl Young used to come here all the time.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, and Vince came here all the time, and Leon used to come here all the time, and Kenny comes and uses the studio at times. I mean, he doesn't really work that much, but, I mean, he has come.
Right. And Vince, was he a keyboard player? Or
he was a vibe player.
Oh, he's a vibe player. Okay. Yeah, I just knew him from Goody Goody, It Looks Like Love. That's I love that song.
He was South Soul Orchestra.
My uncle was a huge South Soul Orchestra.
I played in the South. So I played all those records with him. And, I even went out live with him, but I don't like talking ill of people, you know. So, but he was always a pain in my butt. He always made shit hard, you know. Really? I mean, life should try to make it a little easier, you know. But he would always, like, stir the pot, man.
They needed weed.
Yeah, he did. He did, and he didn't.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. 'Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at Airbnb.com/host.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work and traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured. Not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
The third tier of your story, of course, is you as an arranger. And this is, I mean, just the names alone are straight humble brags. I mean, it's Al Green,
well,
Algebra.
That, you got me that gig.
Well,
I'm just saying, come on. Yeah. I had good friends here. You know.
Well, sometimes it's about the relationships.
Yeah, it is about relationships.
Let's go through them.
So that was cut here. Al Green, y'all did that here?
Huh?
Y'all did the Al Green record here?
Mm-mm. We cut the rhythm tracks at Electric Lady and sent the strings to Larry.
Gotcha.
So there's Al Green, there's Amos Lee, there's Amp Fittler, Angelique Cujo.
Amos Lee grew up Philly. You know that.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Nesby, Anthony Hamilton, Aretha Franklin. Backstreet Boys, Papel Gilberto, Brandy, Bubba Sparxxx.
The Boy Is Mine.
Case, you did the... Whoa.
I did The Boy Is Mine.
You did The Boy Is Mine.
Well, that was when
Rodney Jerkins.
When I opened the studio here, Rodney was my first client.
I was about to say, so, I first met Rodney Jerkins in the studio.
See, here we go back now.
He was 15.
When I was working with Kenny Gamble, that's right. That's mm-hmm. right. When I was working with Kenny Whitehead. Mm. Wrong Kenny. Rodney loved that album. So he came up and introduced he made his father drive him from Atlantic City, yep. Pleasantville, New Jersey, up here to introduce himself to me. Wow. And he was this little kid, you know, and I told Alan Rubens at the time, we were working on some project that he always had me working on different things, whether they were good or bad. And I said, you should let him produce a couple of tracks. Do me a favor. I know he's 14 years old.
I know.
But do me a favor. And Alan Rubens was my age, you know, he's a nice guy. I'd worked for him my whole life. He owned WMOT. Remember that album,
yep.
that label? Okay. Make a long story short.
The Double Dutch Buds.
Yeah. He gave, oh, okay. And you know who represented Rodney Jerkins?
Who?
First time I met
Brad
him.
Brad Rubin.
That's it.
Brad.
And that was the early 90s.
Yeah, during Illa Duff Half-Life. Right. He brought Rodney to the studio. He was 15.
14 or 15.
14, and he was like, Brad's like, this kid's going to run the world one day. And I was looking at you like,
yeah. So, well, guess what? He came to my studio and I had that one of my Wurlitzers there. He sat down and started playing me a Stevie Wonder song. You know, and I said, you're my friend, you know, and beautiful. It was really well thought of. And, you know, and he looked at me, big smile on his face. And he and Kenny got along really well. And yeah, so that was the beginning there. And then I opened this place. Yes, me. I thought by meeting all these really talented young people, I had a feeling that somehow there was going to be a resurgence of the Philly sound. I had a sneaky suspicion.
Before it happened.
It was already happening. Uh-huh. Meeting people like Rodney.
Right.
And having Kenny Whitehead there, having Hit Records right then. Come on. It was happening, you know. So,
and I got to say that Larry, I mean, what really makes the studio special, and even though it's now Milk Boy here and it's a little different.
Well, and I'm not here all the time either, you know, anymore.
Yeah, but I'm just saying that the vibe of this place, the luck. First of all, you made the first studio I've ever seen that has windows in it.
Yeah, I like that.
Next to casinos, I've never seen a business that shuts you out from daylight. I've never been in a studio that gives you any sort of time or date indication whatsoever. So when you go into the reception area,
and you see the whole city.
Sun is out, right?
Yeah, it's just like, you know, I mean, I shot my album cover of Philadelphia Experiment
on the rooftop
here. It's just, it feels like home, you know. I mean, I've spent the night here millions of times. And, you know, my record.
I mean, y'all have not, I mean, thanks to the Roots, y'all have kind of made it home putting, you know, poles and graffiti. And,
we'll get to that.
Okay, I was just, you know,
get to that.
I thought we were going to skip that.
No. That's the main attraction, baby.
But wait.
Well, we need Richard Nichols here. I hate
listen. Come on.
But there's more. There's Bubba Sparxxx. There's Case. There's Change of Faces. There's Charlie Wilson. There's Christina Aguilera. There's Chromeo. There's Coco. There's Common. There's, Daly. Damn, Daly was here too? Mm-hmm. Daryl Hall, John Oates. Dave Koz was here. Jazzy Jeff. Donnell Jones. Drew Hill. Eddie LaVert. Gerald. Oh, man. Yo, the funniest.
The break me off. Break you off. Debacle. Sessions.
No, but not even Matt. Whenever Gerald LaVert came to the studio.
He was here a lot, too.
It was a part. Like, I really miss that guy. You know what I mean? Too.
While we're talking about Gerald, you did the strings for Answering Service?
Yeah.
Oh, man. The intro on that, man?
Yeah.
I think I almost broke that tape just rewinding those strings on that intro over and over again. That was beautiful.
Gerald and beautiful. He was a good friend. He was really a good kid.
King.
I met him at Sigma in the 80s when he had that. LaVert.
Yeah. Back when he used to work with Jim Salamone.
That's right. They did that record together.
Yeah, Jim Salamone used to play. Shout out to Jim Salamone. He used to be my dad's drummer. Eric Benet.
I didn't know that.
Yo, hell yeah.
I didn't know that.
In the 70s, Jim used to drum for my dad. Eric Robeson, Erykah Badu, Flowetry, Glenn Lewis, India Irie, Jagged Edge.
First album, India Irie. Sorry, yeah, I just had to say that.
The Jazzy Fat Nasties, Jennifer Lopez, whom used Bruce Bedian. And his
graced us with her presence for a few weeks.
You did a.
I remember
you
that.
When you guys were up front those two weeks.
We were on our P's and Q's. It was so clean here. We all wore suits.
Oh, wow.
Pulled out, you had catered. The best catered food in the world. Like, there was roses here.
They did that. I didn't do. I did buy flowers, and I bought nice hand soap.
I
upgraded the hand soap.
There was potpourri in the bathroom. Wait a minute, you're playing on Karen Young's Hot Shot.
Yeah,
the disco classic. I was listening to that this morning.
Yeah,
I was just listening to that this morning, just off the stream.
That record was made in a studio that was in Fabric Row off of 4th Street in Philadelphia, in South Philadelphia, that's not there anymore.
Jesus. Wow, I didn't even realize. Going through Kid Cudi.
Amir, I played on thousands of records. Played. They're not listed there. It says a member of MFSB. At some point, it says in some of those credits.
I'm going through everything. You know, but the thing is,
yeah, I did all Kid Cudi's records.
Tell him, Larry. Just say
Kanye.
What about Lana Del Rey's premiere album?
Ah, yeah.
So are you, is it still like, I mean, how often are you doing, are you to the place now where you could just say like, all right, enough, I can't do any more arrangements? Or
I like doing it. So
that's still your, you still get up at 5 a.m. to?
I don't get up at, I do get up, I do get up really early in the morning.
I will.
But I don't come here as obsessively as I used to.
I
would get here at 6 in the morning, and you guys would still be up recording from the night
before. We would creep around mice.
You would laugh a lot about it, and I'd go into my room and work.
We just don't want to interrupt you. So the thing is, like, usually when the sun comes out, I'm like, all right, I better run to the bathroom real quick because I know Larry's about to start his scales. But it's kind of that creeping in the house where, you know, like there's a creak in the floor, that sort of
thing.
You
don't step on that spot, yeah.
Wake up your mom and dad, that sort of thing. So I had like a system of, I know where the special planks are that will give me away, and the squeak of the door and all that stuff. So that was my everyday ritual, like 5:45 a.m. Like, all right, let me do my business before I hear.
Yeah. And so you would still practice your scales every morning?
I still do. I mean, there was a period of time when I was so busy that I really didn't. But now I'm back. But I reversed it. So now I go home like, and I start playing around 3 to 4 in the afternoon, and I play until I have to fall asleep at night.
Wow.
So I enjoy it that much, you know. I mean, I'm still playing, and a lot of times I just start somewhere and I end up somewhere else. But I'm actually playing a little better than I remember. And playing in a while, you know. I mean, I'm about as good as I was when I was maybe 14 right now. But
That's weird how the peaks and valleys and the dips start. Like,
When you don't play, you lose your technique. And you have to rebuild your technique properly. And I'm 71 now. And they're really, a lot of bones you ache, and a lot of things are changed now than when you're little. You know, but it's cool. I'm really liking it.
Yeah, I was going to say, how much in playing the cello, I guess, does the physicality play like in age? Like, is it a like hands thing?
Hands.
It's all hands. So any kind of arthritis or anything that'll slow you up.
Yeah, and you have, there's certain looseness. Amir will tell you, any good musician, the approach to playing, you want it to be real natural, you know, and you don't even want to think about the physicalness of it, right, Amir?
Yeah. Well, I was gonna say, how do you adjust that now? Only recently, Sheila, I told you about the trick that Sheila, you taught me, right? All right, so I'll say that I'm at the very beginning stages of what, I mean, I don't want to put it out there, whatever. I don't know if it's arthritis or carpal tunnel.
You're feeling something.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a lot of tightness.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've been open to CBD oil and all these things to help with the aches and pains. Sheila, you told me, go to Trader Joe's and get the big ass bag of rice, like the family supply of rice, like the big giant supply. Mm-hmm. if I have a refrigerator or a freezer
I've heard of this,
big enough to store it in there to make it cold or whatever, do that. And then right before I drum, just put my entire arm inside the bag of rice and do like a hand rotation motions.
Wow.
And exercise, like warming up your hands. That's something I've never done before. You know, I just come and start playing drums or whatever. But now it's like I'm starting to notice like certain angles of my elbows will start to hurt and that sort of thing. So
are you asking other drummers too? Like that just sound like.
Well, I mean, I came to Sheila. I mean, no one, there's something really weird about between 45 and 55 that I feel like a lot of people are a little too ashamed.
Yeah, they don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, like.
Or admit it, rather.
So, yo, your ankles ever feel like, no, 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 this start to swell or that start. Nobody, there's no one really to talk to, you know. Yeah. Because half the joints I
tried talking to a
age.
70-year-old.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right, right.
But you know, I the other day I watched Bernard Purdy. Sure, it still looks good. I don't know how old he is. His whole process of playing is not like big. It's very small.
Well, every drum teacher I ever had told me from the gate, like, don't use your arms. Use very little hand motion. But of course, you know. You want to show off and show everyone that you're like rock it out, right, rah, right. With your cock out, like that sort of thing. And now I wish I'd listened because, you know, even to hold the remote controls, like,
oh, wow.
You know,
that's. And any kind of wrist wraps, anything like that, don't really.
I don't do wrist wraps. Yo, for real? And that's the thing. I don't know if this is. I believe in CBD oil.
No, as do I.
It's, you know, some people think, like, you I sure think that's not just. You know, placebo syndrome or whatever. But.
Everybody says though when it has some THC in it, which doesn't really get you high.
It doesn't at all.
Right. No, but they mix it with THC. Mm-hmm. Another, I like the pharmaceutical brand that my brother's using right now, is a combination of CBD and THC.
Mm. Same thing.
Oh, is that the same thing?
Well, okay. You can get options.
Right. That's what he. That's,
if you know a friend.
You've changed. I like
you
it.
Live in New York. Medical is legal.
I got friends, man.
Yeah,
because I've changed. Like Laia is a little surprised and dismayed. I had a 1942
shot last night.
I had 1942 on the rocks.
Like, yeah, I peed it. Yeah,
you ordered a shot, Larry. Like it was like we say what now?
Yeah, he had 1942 on the rocks.
Yeah, what did
you
have? Like, oh,
yeah, just one.
I had
somebody's
two.
Growing
had
up.
Well, you know, they took so long to give us the service,
bruh.
Look. That they got us, they had to get us drunk.
Yeah, yeah, that was.
No, I do 1942 because there's no sugar in 1942. So.
Now, you've been sticking to it, man. You've been sticking to it. I'm proud of you,
been
man.
Trying, man. Been trying. Mm-hmm. Trying to be here. I want to be Bernard Purdy.
Yeah, I want you to be too.
Thank you. So, is there anything that you have yet to achieve? Like, do you want to do an orchestral album?
I don't know. I mean, I don't look at life that way right now. I'm, you know, I mean, I had a recent, about a year and a half ago, I almost died. And it took me about 6 months to recover from a trauma injury. And I recovered.
Where you didn't play at all? Or
I couldn't play.
What was
you
that
know,
like?
Well, I started playing a couple of months in, and then I got an infection because I was bending my leg. It's a I don't want to talk about it right now.
Okay.
It's a complicated thing. I got gangrene.
Oh, man.
And they had to remove a part of my leg, and they destroyed the nerves. They didn't destroy. They cut the nerves in my leg. So I had to sort of relearn some stuff. And they didn't want, I started playing about a month or two when I came home from the hospital. I was in the hospital about two and some weeks, and I came home and I started playing and my leg blew way up and I got some infection and I had to go on. So I was told I had to be reclined for another few weeks. And then I started playing again and it helped me. And then smoked a lot of pot because I wasn't going to.
You said that helped you a lot.
I wasn't going to do the opioids.
Yeah,
you know,
man,
so,
don't fuck with this
shit. In the hospital, they had me high as a kite on Dilaudid, you know. And then as soon as they were letting me go home, because you get sick in the hospital sometimes from hospital stuff. You know, they want to get you home as fast as they can so you don't get sick from infections. Right. Make a long story short. They cut your Dilaudid like to nothing. They don't want to send you home with pills anymore. It's not It's not very popular. So I said, hold the pills. I'm going to buy a bag of pot. And we proceeded to go right and buy a bag of pot. And I was, I was up most of the time with pain, but I was smoking it like crazy. Like I was a young hippie again. And I got real into it. And then I looked at Vicky and I said, we're going to buy a half a pound. So,
you know? Larry,
we're doing the old days. We're going to have the freezer full.
How you feeling the pot these days? Because, pot didn't change since at first you started. Like, how you feeling the...
It was reefer back
wait a minute, first of all.
I was just asking.
I didn't miss... There were a few years where I was, like, drinking stuff and doing other stuff. But then when I got back, I went right... I knew a guy... I have a friend at Humboldt County. I just got a pound of marijuana, man.
Wow. Damn, you got straight to the plug.
Got straight to the... Yeah. And guess what?
Let's hear for miracles.
It helped me heal.
Well, I'm glad you're here, man.
Me too.
I still ask Larry.
And I'm
like,
still smoking about a bag a week, so what the hell?
Yo, Steve, he's outdoing you, Steve.
Yeah, anything left from the pound?
that pound's way gone.
The pound's gone? All right, just checking.
Steve's checking right now. All right, Larry, I thank you so much for doing this. I appreciate it.
Yes.
Still waiting for the Don Cello part two, though. No. The Don Cello part two. That was my album.
Thank you for having me.
Remember the Don nice and Donnie and everybody?
Yes, of course.
Thank you, Larry.
Yeah. The song that he did.
He did Ain't No Stopping Us Now and stuff.
Black Heart. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But I mean, the song that we did with, she's singing on, who did Deanna also manage?
Carol Riddick.
That song that's on his record.
That was your track.
Oh, yeah. That's a good track. Yeah.
That song was initially Love of My Life.
Yeah.
That song would have been where Love of My Life was when Things Fall Apart.
Right.
Man. And then...
It was sort of tossed aside.
Well, yeah, when Common decided he liked what you know as Love of My Life,
then
we had to give this track away.
Oh,
and
man,
I did not want to give up that song.
I just thought of a question real quick before we go. So, Claire Fisher, I was always curious to hear from another string arranger, like what you thought about his arrangements and what made him like so
I always
so
put... So whenever I give him something, my first words are...
He would always say, make it like Clay.
Make it like Claire Fisher. No, but you, when we did, what's the Dilla song? When we did the Can't Stop This, Game Theory. Oh my God,
No,
man.
We did a lot of nice records
I think I might have went in the room and cried a little bit, man. It was hard. It was really hard to mix that song. There was one point where me and Russ started crying because, I mean, the thing is like it keeps reminding you that Dilla's no longer here. And then, like, I was just like, all right, I don't want to hear. I told Russ, like, I don't want to hear what Larry did because I know that when them strings get added, it's going to make it even sadder. So I was just like, call me 45 minutes before you want to print the final, and then I'll come in and listen to it once.
But that's why some of those records were so great, though.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, you guys weren't afraid of feelings, and, you know, I mean, and they were selling then, too, you know? I mean, it was really a nice time in my life. You gave me a nice renaissance, you know? Well,
you gave us a home. Yeah, and that's, you know, once again,
there's no problem.
Bravo to you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of Laia Fontigolo and half of Bill and Sugar Steve, this is Questlove, Questlove Supreme. We will see you on the next go round. Thank you.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cb for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring? but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring, and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.